good to hear. I either have to set up the 7,000 in the shack. That's not going to work in another month when I finally move it back to the truck, but I need to find myself a DR-435. I'm just painfully, rigid in what I want, only because I want the human factors to be alike so they don't have to master five different radios simultaneously for essentially the same function. But anyway, so if anyone's got a DR-435, in fact, if you have any of the DR-135, 235, 435, or some of the newer 6 and 10 meter radios and you're not happy with them, please let me know. We can always make a deal for something else, or money, or something like that. Anyway, alrighty. I'm going to go to Helmut's question or comment, whichever order he wants, and then we'll come back to more check-ins. This is K2BAR.
K2BDU. Thank you, Gwen, and good evening to all. My question is, do ground radios affect the directivity of a vertical antenna? Over.
Do what affect the pattern of a vertical antenna?
The ground rods, or counterpoise grounds, if they affect the directivity.
I would think so, but depends on where they're placed. And like, for instance, there's a lot of discussion as to whether or not you should have a ground rod underneath your vertical. The answer is yes. There's another discussion as to whether, if you do that, should you ground the wires at the far end of your counterpoise? I don't know. I have different... it certainly couldn't hurt. It certainly couldn't hurt. That would be my opinion. However, I'm going to immediately hot potato this one to our resident antenna maven, K2ZO.
Hey, K2BAR, K2ZO. First of all, you don't really get any directivity. What you do change is the angle of attack that the signal leaves above the antenna. As you add more and more radials, you get lower and lower angle of radiation. And of course, it's universal in all directions if you are symmetrical with the radials. And remember, if it's a quarter wave, it'll be effectively a ground down at the far end anyway. So you really don't need to ground them. But the more radials you add, the lower the angle, and actually the lower the impedance of the antenna. So you could start off with two radials or so and have it at 50 ohm impedance, and by the time you get 30 radials, you're down to about 20 ohms impedance, and then you have to change your matching circuit. So that's one of the interesting things about vertical antennas. But more radials means a lower angle of attack, a lower angle of that the signal's going to leave, and more DX.
Okay, well, just to go back to the point I was making, is that I think there's some view that especially on 80 and 160 and maybe even 40, a lot of people think that it's a great idea to put some form of earth ground at the far end. As you point out, it is at earth ground, for me, it is at, you know, ground potential, but you have no way of cleanly discharging the or keeping the stray currents down. I mean, the current point should be low at that point, but some people think that it's good for keeping the static down to a dull roar. If you really want to get into a fist fight over how to, you know, the geometry of radials, not just the count, and whether or not they should be grounded, go up on Tower Talk and ask, or go through the archives of messages from last year on the subject of elevated versus buried versus on the ground verticals. In other words, essentially elevating the antenna, therefore elevating the radials versus having them on the ground or in the ground. Oh my God, what a discussion that is.
That's for sure.
Yeah, really. I'm not even sure at the end of the day I saw consensus on that, but I think the general view is an analog to what Jim was saying, and that is, however you wish to lower the takeoff angle, you should be the closest to physical ground as possible, and the best way to do that is more radials, but if you want to actually cause a high takeoff angle for any reason with a vertical, which is a whole other question, do you really want to do that? A higher takeoff angle, you can elevate your radials, and you will get a higher takeoff angle up to a certain point, and then there's a question as to whether or not you lower it by having lots of radials, but you've elevated the antenna. So you do that, you know, 32 radials thing, but you're a quarter wave at the bottom of your antenna above the ground. Well, at that point, there's all sorts of interesting discussions as to what you've got. I'm going to throw it back to Jim for his comment.
Okay, yeah, we could beat this subject to death. The answer is that most people don't have the ideal setup to really evaluate most of these type things. But above-ground radials really do work well. They're unsightly, and they're inconvenient, and not really suited well to home environments.
But if you can get them up in the air, then supposedly you can lower your takeoff angle, right?
Yeah, but for the most part, verticals are not the best antennas for work in DX when other people are horizontally polarized. However, on 160 and 80 meters, yeah, but certainly not on the other frequencies.
Yeah, and then the question is, how do you get both ends of all the radials up in the air at a quarter wavelength? Therein lies the rub. I think you'd probably be better off ground mounting them or burying them and having more of them than you would trying to elevate a bunch of them, let's just say four. Elevating four at a quarter wavelength would perform less well than, you know, 16 or 30 or even perhaps 8 directly on the ground, don't you think?
That's very true, but as I say, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a lot of work no matter what you do. Absolutely. On the other hand, if you can build your own answer to Stonehenge, you'll be in good shape. I think at the end of the day, if you look at the vertical arrays, especially the four squares of some of the big DX stations for 160 or 80 or 40 and occasionally 20, you'll find they all have intense radial fields buried, usually buried in the ground. So that kind of answers the question in a nutshell. Anyway, enough is enough. Anybody else have any comment about this directionality issue? I think our basic answer for you, Helmut, is that, you know, do what you want, do what you can, because more radials are good no matter where they go, and they'll make your pattern as symmetric as you possibly can. So the ground rod in itself is not the issue, per se. So, anybody else have any comments? Let's call K2BAR.
K2JK.
Who is checking in, and will you have questions, or you already have a comment. Will you have questions, Don?
No questions, Gordon, just a comment on this subject.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, I know one of the big guns on 160 is K1ZM. I read that book on they had about 160 meters that the ARRL was publishing. And he's got like 400 and some radials. Now, I mean, the broadcast station is supposed to have 120. But this guy found reason to put 400 and I don't know how many, 470 radials or something down. So I guess that tells you something. He's one of the top guns on 160. But I think what happens is you get to a point where there's a point of no return where after 120, there's only a small difference, let's say, from 120 to 240. So you know, think about it. That's a lot of wire to be putting down, too, especially on 160. But I'm just reading an article here in the QRP Quarterly by Gary Breed, K9AY, who's a guru on it, and he's asking how many radials, and he's got a very good article here. There's a lot of... I guess the answer to the question is to put as much down as you can. Don't try try to stick you directional. I think if you're using a ground-mounted vertical, you've got to remember that dealing with other kinds of ground clutter, you've got your neighbor's house and your house and whatever with all the metal in it, and possibly a house full of aluminum siding or whatever. It's not directions. I don't care how many radios you got. It's going to be blocked by the aluminum siding. So that affected the figure. Now, in my own case, I have a vertical, but it's mounted on the roof. It's a half feet of aluminum tubing with eight radials strung out on the roof. And it worked pretty good for me. So whatever you can do, I guess, is the best you can. Back to that, 72JK.
Okay, very good. Now, that was informative. So you're getting reasonable 20-meter performance with eight radials. That's good to know. I think the lower frequencies, though, more is better. It's probably more is better any frequency, but, you know, more is better. In general, I think probably 120 radials is recommended because probably the influence of 3 degrees across these frequencies is sufficient. Cross-coupling that, you know, additional radials don't really help. As I mentioned before, the law of diminishing returns kind of applies. Alrighty. Anybody else have comments about Helmut's question? Okay, Helmut, back to you. K2BDU. Any more on this question? And did you want to make another comment?
K2BDU. I thank you, gentlemen, for the answers, but I still would like to find out if I only put two rods there, 180 degrees apart, if that would affect the directivity. But we can find that out at a later date, or I buy a book. Thank you again.
Oh, there's no question. It's going to have more of a lobe in the direction of those radials, absolutely. But the question you asked is if you ground the antenna, or ground the radio, that was the question. So yes, you will have more directionality in the direction of those two radials.
Thank you.
Okay, any other comment? Mr. J. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, my general understanding, and I'm sure there are people here who can correct me, is ground rods are, I think he said rods, are actually, yeah, fine for lightning protection, but they don't really have a whole lot of value from an RF standpoint in ordinary soil. It takes a radial to be particularly useful. And the speculation, not knowing anything else on that station with 400 radials, would seem like he may have cut radials for several different bands, although somehow it seems like enormous overkill.
Yeah, absolutely, and you're right. It was ground rods, not ground plane or radials. But in any case, I think Helmut has his directional answer at this point. The answer is in two directions. He'll have, you know, elongation, if you will, of what otherwise would be a theoretically circular pattern. Alrighty. I know I'm thinking about shunt feeding my tower with the 20-odd feet of masting on top of it. It's 67 feet plus whatever coupling I get out of the G7-144. But at 67 feet, it's a halfway of my 40, so it's kind of got my full attention. It's a quarter wave on an 80, so I was thinking of running some wires any which way I could from the base of the tower, because I mean, it's a grounded tower, so I was thinking of shunt feeding this sucker, using a piece of PVC to hold, you know, or shroud a, you know, a feeder arm, and feed it with essentially a gamma match or a tap or something. That would be my approach to it. I'd only be able to run essentially three radios, and run one forward down my driveway and under my lawn, which would be, I mean, it's bent, but generally to the east. I'd have another one that goes generally to the west, and probably bend to the south. Another one that goes to the northwest, and would probably be full length. So that's kind of with that idea. So I'm just kind of curious. I might be able to run a fourth one to the north along the house, but that'll be bent as well, because the first, like, 20 feet or 15 feet, it has to go west. The ones to the west all have to go parallel about 15 feet before they go in their three different directions. So, Jim, let's start with you and S2K. What do you think about that configuration? Basically, the three or four kind of bent up radials and generally four directions, sort of kind of, and shunt feeding the tower. What do you think about that?
The four radials of any description are sure better than none. obviously, if you could tune them in a band, fine. If you make them as long as you can, fine. Bent, who knows? I'm sure it makes a difference, but hey, the more copper you have down there, the better. Shunt feeding. I don't know. I'm looking at broadcast stuff, and sometimes you find shunt feed, but usually the ones that I've had anything to do with, which isn't very many, are all insulated base. It's a base fed antenna, which of course makes it interesting from a lightning standpoint.
Well, yeah, you know, I don't have a lot of choice. I mean, the tower's already up, right? So I was thinking of essentially making a gamma match up the side of the tower and to the feed point and the radios, and that would be my, you know, basically use a clamp to, you know, on an arm, a conductive arm, out to the vertically hanging thing, which would be, you know, probably a piece of like number six or something, inside number six, that's kind of stiffened with a piece of PVC toward the ground, and then just feed it at the bottom of a piece of wire near the ground on the shunt side. And I guess I have a big capacitor there too, right? So I'd need a capacitor as well to put kind of out at the end of the, you know, basically where the horizontal arm goes vertical. I would probably put a capacitor out there. I think that's the way I would do it, right? So bolt on the horizontal tap, go out, let's say, a foot or so from the tower, put the capacitor out there, and then run the piece of number six vertically. And by varying the length of the number six and varying where it touches the tower, where it's clamped to the tower, that's how I would tune the thing, I guess. So, what say you, NS2K, K2BAR?
Yeah, probably. I assume you're using the tower for other purposes as well, so you're running coax and stuff up. I would think, and Jimmy should certainly be able to correct me, that you would want to connect all of your coaxes and control cables at the point where the ground plane meets the antenna, that being, you know, ground zero, as it were. All of this stuff should connect at that point, the shields, so that you minimize the amount of RF from your driven element, the tower itself, onto the other coax. I don't know. I would think that Jim would have a comment on that. And Mr. K.
Say, Jim.
Yeah, it's an absolute yes. Go ahead, Jim.
Now, one of the problems to doing that is, of course, as you say, Jim, is RF. The secret to doing a lot of that is running the rotator control cables inside the tower, not letting them outside. And, of course, yes, as you say, grounding them at that point, because a number of years ago, I had a friend who did that, and the first thing that happened was he burned out the rotator control box. The first thing that the lights flashed and everything else went up in smoke, because it was coupling RF into it. So, yeah, if you've got to do that, you've got to run all of that stuff inside the tower where it's relatively cool to RF, and of course, be careful at where you point when you do ground it.
You realize that you just trashed my entire project.
I kind of figured that, because you got everything on the outside of the tower.
Oh, it's worse. It's far worse. I there was somebody else who wanted to make a comment, and we'll get you in a second. I just thought about it. I said, oh my God, I mean, I have, you know, 11 or 13, depending on my last count, coaxes, two rotator control lines, another twisted pair of thingy, all going through my bulkhead here, and it's bad enough it doesn't all go down to the base of the tower for grounding and then come back up. I don't do that. I cheated, and I ground everything to the plate, and I got a piece of dumbawat going bonded to the tower, going all the way down to the two ground rods at the bottom of the tower. So it's grounded to each section of the tower along the way from basically my ground plate, my tower leg at the point of the ground plate, which is, by the way, two stories in the air, or three stories in the air, pardon me. And everything is all bonded to the tower all the way down to the ground rod. So there's absolutely no way, I mean, no way I can do that. I also have other wire antennas in the air, it's not going to work. It just, you know, silly me, I'm delusional, well, more delusional than normal, so I think I'll pass on this. What I may do, however, is put a 20-meter vertical, I could probably do a 40-meter vertical in the backyard and have prettier radials, and that probably would be better. I could do that in the backyard without any problem, without anything being interfered with, I think. That'd probably be a better choice. Mr. NS2K first, and then K2ZO, and then we'll get our mystery person.
The coaxes and stuff should be bonded at the bottom, bonded at the antenna feed point, so on, and yeah, bonded all the way up. That's not a problem. But as they're going to, one way or the other, they're going to be lit up. Probably the same as the tower. The trick is you don't want any potential differences anywhere. Now, I don't know, with some commercial stuff, they run transformers, high voltage RF transformers, for power and that sort of thing, called Austin Ring transformers. They're really an impressive thing. I got some pictures here somewhere of a fairly recent installation. These things are like, I don't know, 2 or 3 feet in diameter, probably 3 feet in diameter. They're pretty impressive. Two transformer coils at right angles with each other the loop goes through the center of the other one in each case. Needless to say, not an inexpensive thing to buy, especially for high voltage. And then, of course, you have to have an arc over device. Anyway, it makes it all very interesting, but it'll isolate the RF from the on the ground side from the antenna side. Anyway, isolating, not rising the whole thing. That's going to be an interesting project. But the whole thing, I think, is key. It's going to be zero at the base of the tower, you know, at some point, and then they take off from there, along with a heavy ground wire that follows them to the next lightning protection point, NS2K.
Yeah, that was the issue. I mean, in my case, since I have a third floor shack, I've taken some steps, and I still have to do more, to create a ground rod field at the base of the tower at 10-foot intervals along the driveway, along the foundation of the house. I have the ground rods either in, but not bonded together, or a couple of additional ones to pound in on the back part of the driveway. But I'm going to bond them all together with wide strapping in order to get that, you know, maximum earth ground, and it'll all be the same potential as the utility ground for the house, which is, so basically I'm bonding, if you will, my tower ground to the utility grounds that are along the same side of the house, and that'll keep everything at one happy potential, and reduce any ground loop potentials as well. But in any case, the third floor, you know, ham shack poses some issues, and one of them is, especially at VHF, I have zero interest in running coax 50 feet down and 50 feet back. That just is not happening. So I've taken the compromise to, for the antennas that are mounted on this tower on the side of the house, to couple of nights, and it was good to note that we didn't have a problem. Alrighty, K2ZO, you take it. K2BR.
Okay, very good. So I think you kind of covered that deal pretty good. By the way, I managed to solve the problem of RF getting into the CO monitor by cutting a circle the same diameter of the detector, which is plastic, and putting it on the back of it. Believe it or not, it stopped it. So it was enough of a Faraday shield or whatever. Back to that, K2ZO.
Oh, slow down, Spunky. Talk to me. What did you do? I mean, you actually looked at the little quarter-sized hole and you covered it?
No, not the hole where it senses the CO, but just a shield. Just put a piece of aluminum behind it, and you'll see that it, in my case, it stopped the RF from triggering it.
Okay, this is... So you took off the cover, and you're looking at the circuit board, and actually, I don't know, but you can take off the cover of mine. Mine, you take off the back cover. I don't know if you can take off the top cover. But anyway, you took off the front cover, and then where did you put this?
No, I didn't take off anything. All I did is take the remember, this whole thing is plastic. On the back of it, where it goes up against the wall, and there's two screws that hold it to the wall, I took a piece of aluminum foil and put it there and trimmed it around so you can't see it, and that was enough, because where I had it was where the wiring from the doorbell transport was just going up the wall, and I thought that that's where the RF was being picked up and coupled into it. So by putting that piece of aluminum, which acted as a Faraday shield, you know, right behind it, it stopped it. And it may not do it for you, but it worked for me.
Okay, I just went and verified something. The carbon monoxide detector on the third floor is not here. It's downstairs. Because when I had it on my desk, it was a problem. So we solved the problem by, I kind of annoyed my family. I just said, do not turn on the upstairs heater. We only use it as an air conditioner. It's enough heat gravitating upstairs, so we don't need the upstairs heater, because we have a combo unit up here. So, right now, we're not using it at all, so there's no chance of combustion, therefore there's no chance of it kicking on. But that detector went off even when it was sitting on my desk here on the third floor. But you still raise a good question. It wasn't, the wiring wasn't apparently, at least my installation, an issue, because I proved that by having the, moving the CO2 detector, 10 feet, leaving it on my desk, so it's maybe 4 feet lower, but maybe 8 feet closer to the antenna than it had been. And I'm thinking if I put that Faraday shield on the back of the unit, that may well solve the problem. So I will try that. That's very cool. We'll try that during the day when like half the neighborhood's not home or something. I'll plug it in the morning and try it, because the old strategy was to basically we'll go in the hallway, take the connector, pop the connector, take the battery out and leave it on the desk. Well, it's now sitting next to the other unit, actually sitting on top of the stairs, in standalone mode, top of the basement stairs, in case theoretically the basement one doesn't work, the one near the downstairs furnace, but that's where the other one is. So anyway, if the code requires you have one near each furnace. So anyway, such is life. I'm glad we solved that mystery. Alrighty, there was a mystery commenter or check-in. Why don't we go to you, K2BAR? Your call sign, your name, and whether or not you have a question or comment, or none of the above.
W2JEK with a comment about the gamma match.
Okay, we'll get you in a second, Don. Anybody else? Okay, go ahead, Don.
Yeah, you mentioned putting the gamma match capacitor right up high on the tower. I think it worked just as well if you had it down on the ground or your ground. ground level where you could reach the thing, but rough ground that tweak the gamma match while somebody's watching the SWR meter, and you'd be loading up the tower. It's better to have something like that convenient us than over.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of using a fixed capacitor in a variant position, but you know, you're absolutely right. It's a lot easier just to take a swag at where you're going to bolt it, leave it there, run the wire down, and put the capacitor in place. But given my newfound thought of a vertical in the backyard, I'm thinking it's going to be a 40-meter vertical, you know, 33 feet or so. That'll be 8 feet in the air. Speaking of elevated radials, by the way, all my radials will be elevated. They'll either be wired into the pergola, they'll be wired into fences, they'll be wired into the top of the shed, they'll be wired all sorts of places, but I have a place at the end of the deck where there's, toward the back of the yard, but not at the absolute back, where I could very nicely put a 40-meter vertical. So, what the heck, I probably will. I might even have if I have a 12-footer, I can drop it 4 feet in the ground and still be 8 feet in the air. If I already have an 8-footer standing up, probably use a 12-footer, I'll think about it. But when the weather's warmer and I feel like doing that kind of stuff, God knows I have the aluminum to do it, so this is kind of cool. Thank you, K2GL, for those who might have ever been there. Alrighty, any other check-ins for the net, please call KQBAR. Alrighty, so we have a couple of announcements, I assume. I don't know how last weekend's meeting went. I was at in my living room with my family watching the Cardinals choke. It was good to see Uncle Billy. I'll leave my political comments alone, but other than to say that the wrong team won. But it was theirs to lose, and they managed to, but they beat the odds. That's the key. So, you know, Las Vegas paid. It's a beautiful thing. Anyway, anybody who want to make some comments, let's see, Jim, why don't you talk about Kid Night and some upcoming other events. Why don't you do that, K2BAR.
Okay, K2BAR. This is K2ZO. Just like everybody know, Kid Night's moving right along. If you buy something, the club will pay 50% of it up to a total of, I think, $100, which is a pretty good deal if you want to build it at Kid Night. And, of course, we do have the auction coming up. And for the folks listening out there, please remember this is an auction, and this is March 1st. Apparently, it got listed as a ham fest in some locations. And I'm getting emails from people saying, why are you having a ham fest on March 1st? We'll be freezing. And the answer is no. It is inside in the cafeteria at 12 o'clock noon, and it is an auction. So if you're listening out there, tell your folks. Back to that K2ZO.
All righty. That's good. That's good. Yeah, it's going to be fun. The first Sunday in March. And that's a beautiful thing. So, we're looking forward to that ourselves. And, yes, it will be March 2nd. It'll be March 1st. Yes, you said that already. Sorry about that. Okie doke. Let's see, what else is about? Anybody have any comments about last weekend's meeting? I heard there was a change of speaker and program. So how did it go? Maybe Bruce can tell us. WG2Y, K2BAR.
WG2Y, Gordon, Steve just basically received the bulletin information from Joyce. Really nothing earth-shattering. There was just some legislation or action going on to help the hams living in restricted places to be able to erect some sort of antenna. There was some matters concerning the publicity committee or part of the ARRL, and there was an awful lot more than that I could remember. I did make some notes. But just to clarify one matter on the kits, all right, the reimbursement, yes, is in effect up to $50. So you get a $100 kit, you'll get $50 back. However, you're only allowed one kit per calendar year, gang. So remember that as you go through that. So back to that. K2BAR, WG2Y.
Ah, we have a refinement of the process. Alrighty. Very good. Well, I just regarding the software-defined radio stuff, I emailed Tony Parks about availability of some of his kits, and the receiver that we're interested in, that HF receiver, it will receive the AM broadcast band. There's an additional kit module you have to buy, but it all is, you know, in the software programmable world, so it's all controllable from your computer, and so there's no issue there, and it will go down to 100 kilohertz with some reasonable dexterity. That's a beautiful thing, and so be aware of that. The other thing to be aware of is that if his back order list has, you know, diminished sufficiently on or about the 15th or 16th of the month, then and only then will he take new orders. So I tried to get that that one receiver kit, which is probably at this point. Yeah, I find it ironic. I was kind of asking, puzzling why Jim was ordering a receiver kit, and he explained why, and I shook my head for a couple of times. We must have had at least two or three conversations on the subject. I find myself buying a receiver kit for essentially the same reason Jim did. So your gentle persuasion and your example, Jim, is well appreciated, despite yourself. Hi. But I still want to go after the transceiver kit afterwards, the 1-watt, 3-band transceiver, but I figure I can wait on that. I figure I'd cut my teeth on the receiver. I've kind of wanted to have a software-defined radio that I could possibly even access remotely in the future. That's kind of where I want to go as a general listening device. I think that'd be kind of cool. Shortwave radio out in the country or something like that. That's kind of what I want to do ultimately, but I can play with it. I was actually thinking of getting a good internet connection at one of our camps, setting it up there, and then you know, backhauling it here and see what I could do with it. It'd be kind of fun. So we shall see. Let's see. All right, I have another question. I have a radio, an ADI mobile rig that's been misbehaving. I found that ADI's microphone standard is the same as Kenwood's, so an MC43 or something like that will work fine. And so I thought I had a mic problem. I changed mics, and the problem was persistent with the radio. It seems that RF getting in the radio does some really bad things. So, well, I was wondering if anyone's had prior experience with too many FM rigs with RF getting into the radio and totally trashing up the signals and such. Is this a generic problem to this radio, a generic problem to, you know, that vintage of 2-meter radio, or is there a problem with my radio that I have to go solve, which is fine too. I mean, I'm wondering if even it's got an antenna, a cable, and a pigtail, and I'm wondering if that pigtail maybe has come unglued, but I'll certainly try to fix that. Does anybody have any thoughts on the subject? Please call K2BAR.
Just try it into a dummy load and see if what happens.
Well, there's sometimes the simple answer is the right answer. And God knows I have a good dummy load. I have several. Okay, I will try that and see if the problem persists. And put a watt meter in between the dummy load and the, off the end of the pigtail, to see if flexing the pigtail actually causes the signal to go up and down. That might be an issue, too.
That'll be a good test. That's always a good thing to try. And I am going to scoot out here. I'm freezing down here in this basement. So 73 alls, K2ZO.
Okay, can someone please get a little catalytic heater for Jim? Now that he's cleared the space, he can safely run one without setting his house on fire.
I can always put that between K on this. I'll be nice for
him. You know, this is probably more energy efficient than your Henry 3K filament.
73.
Okay, who was the other station? Someone wanted to make some obnoxious comment, but you got stepped on by Jim. 73, Jim. Okay, no one wants to share their obnoxious comment. That's no fun. Alrighty. That was my question for the evening. And let's see. Oh, I had something I had to do recently. One of my scouts last weekend decided to drop a Klondike Derby sled directly on my $90 3-band 220-440 multi-band NMO mount whip that was screwed into the edge of my roof rack. He dropped the sled on it and wondered why the plastic shell broke. Well, the good news is he didn't destroy anything but the shell. He didn't malform anything, didn't, you know, twist it around. So we carefully unscrewed the base and kept the body, you know, in sync with the whole thing. I brought it home, did my best to clamp it as best I could after wetting both sides, and epoxied it back together. So it looks like it's got a really ugly circular scab around the shattered shell. And I do want to let people know that it seems sturdy enough after a few days to try. I kind of banged it around and swung it around like a sword, you know, holding the antenna side and to see if the base would, you know, come apart. And it has not. It hasn't even flexed. So that's a good thing. And all I used was that epoxy that comes in the parallel tubes, and you kind of, you know, snap off the end and you work with it. So you kind of mix it on a piece of paper or something like that and, you know, just roll it up. So I fixed the antenna and saved myself a lot of a $90 investment. So I'm rather proud of myself. So I tested here in the shack. It seems to have good SWRs. I have a little test ground plane that I can use with it. So I am pleased with that. So one down, one to go. So anybody else have any interesting antenna or repair issues they might have done recently? I'd be curious. K2BAR. Wow. Okay. I have another thing. I wish I had the pieces to do it, but one of the little battery packs for my THF6, actually the big 3600 milliamp R1, broke the little clip off the top. It's cast, it's molded as part of the case. And I dropped the radio, it shattered the little retainer piece that's part of the little, shall we say, piece on the top. If anyone has a THF6 battery, unclick it, and you'll see a little thing in the center on the top. That little cross piece that, you know, has a little bite underneath fell off. So I've been trying to figure strategies for replacing it, but replace it with what that's going to be sturdy enough and rigid enough. I mean, I can apply epoxy and trim the epoxy and shape the epoxy, but I need something that will bridge across the gap and allow provide a little bit of edge lift underneath. And I can't seem to find any plastic or metal that's small enough and, you know, rigid enough at the same time to fit that role. Does anybody have any suggestions? Please call K2BAR.
W2JEK.
Don, go right ahead.
Yeah, one thing I was putting my 2-meter ground plane together. Tony suggested that I use some epoxy putty and stuff up, and it hardens actually after a short period of time, and I put it on the top of the antenna. Maybe that would be the thing, rather than that stuff that comes out of the tube that's a liquid kind of a thing, putty that might be more manageable for what you want to do. Back to you.
You like the JB Weld stuff?
I don't know the brand name of it. I had some here that I was using to make a swimming pool repair. Works good underwater.
Oh, really? Yeah, well, I assume this does too, because it's showing plumbing and automotive applications as well here. I have two tubes of the JB Weld stuff, so yeah, we could try that. The trick is just to shape a little cylinder across it, and it's got to be, well, I guess I can elevate it. The real trick is how to make it, you know, have a lip. Well, you know what? Right now, if I want to use this particular battery, I have to take a big postal rubber band, you know, the ones that are like half an inch wide, and use one of those to hold the battery in place. And, of course, it kind of moves around, jostles, so it can't hurt. It can't hurt. I called the battery manufacturer and asked them if they could send me a new housing. They told me they can sell me a new battery for $80, so needless to say, I was not impressed. All right, well, thank you for that thought. comments, confusions for the net tonight, please call K2BAR. Okay, a note from Ron, WB2GAI. He would like people to sign up with their Reese's organizations, because currently, unless you're a member of the Ramsey Reese's OEM team, there's really no place for you to go because they're standing in for Aries. He feels that, and many people do, that the OEMs have other activities other than normal Reese's operations to do. So if normal Reese's operations are your thing or not your thing, there's probably still some place for you to go. Unfortunately, Ramsey's capped. They can't take you. But he's encouraging people to join a local Reese's in a town near you. It doesn't have to be your town, a town. And you can either ask him for a Reese's application, or you can ask me. I have some as well. And they're electronic, so it's not a big deal. But you take it to either your OEM coordinator or the OEM coordinator in the town you're going to register with. An example would be like Noel registers with JKY in Carlstadt because his town doesn't have an active Reese's organization. But, they're looking to provide ham radio operators off the Reese's list. And when Aries gets put back together, it'll probably become more integrated once again. But under whose auspices and how, that's yet to be determined. But that's probably not until at least May they're talking. So if you're interested, contact Ron or contact me, and I'll send you out the form. He will, whichever you prefer. All right, any other check-ins for the net, please call K2BAR with your call sign, your name, and whether or not you have a question or comment for the net.
W2TTT, this is KC2PYB.
Go ahead, Mr. Ron.
This is Richard, not Ron. I know what I'm doing.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Richard. I'm brain dead. Noted. In fact, if you live in Fort Lee, you'd like to hear from him too, yes?
Yeah, but there's a little bit more than just filling out a form in Fort Lee. We actually train our people. We just don't say, hey, you got a license, go for it. There is no generic Reese's form to register. OEM, and you must be a member of an OEM, or as the old regulations, which haven't been changed, says a civil defense corps. The only generic form that I'm aware of is the one that the state has to register you, which you have to attach your license to, and it has to be signed by your OEM coordinator appointing you. Then becomes your appointment when it comes back, signed by the county and state. So there are no generic forms. Just fill out and whoopee, here I go. I'm a Reese's radio operator.
Oh, that's true. And the signatory boxes, the state form I'm looking at, municipal or county emergency management radio officer, signed and dated, emergency or county emergency management coordinator, which is what you just said, as well as your signature. And then, as you said, it goes up, you know, with the copy of your driver's license or a suitable government ID, a Social Security card, or something else bearing your name and your Social Security number that's federally issued as well, like you can use your passport, I found out, and a copy of your FCC amateur license, and that gets pumped up through the food chain, just like you said. So anyway, absolutely, Rich, you're on the money. So, anybody else with comments, please call K2BAR. Alrighty. Well, if no one has any more questions, comments, confusions, I think we'll dispense with the net for tonight. I have one last announcement, and that is kind of a plea for support. During the month of February, and if it's successful, extend to beyond there, anytime someone goes to the Tri-Valley Restaurant, which many of you know to be on Knickerbocker Road in Dumont, it's across the street from one of the check-ins homes, actually. But if you buy so much as a roll and a cup of coffee, coffee, 10% goes to our Boy Scout troop and will help fund our effort to go to the National Boy Scout Jamboree in 2010. So if people would make a point on Wednesdays of supporting Troop 139 by mentioning Boy Scouts when you go in there for your cup of coffee or your lunch or your meal or your breakfast, whatever, your dinner, that would be greatly appreciated, really, really would. And if you want to sit there and holler at me, most Wednesdays during February, you can do that around 7 o'clock. I'll be there to be hollered at. Be more than happy to be hollering with you. Hi, hi. So, anybody else with questions, comments, confusions, please call K2BAR. Okay, very good. And by the way, we had one more radio merit badge completed as a result of our licensing course. The young man still hasn't passed his test. He's only taken it twice, and taken it once in each of two sessions, and he keeps missing by one question and doesn't want to retake it the same day. So I had several scouts from my troop who took it way more times than he has and had much more difficulty passing. Talked to him. He was visiting from another troop on Tuesday, so we'll have to get another ham in short order, I'm sure. But there's also some discussion about having another class on the Friday after Easter. So a good Friday plus 1 week. So if there's any interest in staffing that, please see me. And Venture Crew 7373 and Troop 139 and anybody else who wants to sponsor it will be more than welcome to pull it off. The good news is that we have the date. The bad news is we don't have Joel, but we can make do, I'm sure. So any other volunteers on that subject, please see me whenever you can. And I'll leave it one more time for questions, comments, confusions, late check-ins. This is K2BAR. Okie doke. Anyway. You know something? I just what happens when you watch television. I need to put actually, NSUK, if you can hang around after the net, but I need to put closed captioning up on my television. I'm not sure exactly how to do that. I'm embarrassed to say. But Lindsey Graham, in certain postures, looks like a weak chin version of William F. Buckley. Anyway, like if William F. Buckley had a wee little brother, it'd be Lindsey Graham. But anyway, don't mind me. All right. So, on that bizarre note, I want to thank the Bergen County FM Association for the use of the repeater. We encourage our check-ins and anyone who's listening, actually, to support the Bergen County FM Association. It's our brother club. And if you would like to attend our next meeting, it's going to be, as we said, 1 o'clock for buyers and noon for sellers at the Westwood High School in Washington Township on the first Sunday in March. And we hope to see you there. So with that being said, I think we're good to go, and we can talk with you later. So thank you very much. This is K2BAR, Gordon, W2TTT, returning the repeater to normal amateur use.